brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's Matthew with you here. If you listened to an episode of this show in July last year, it was around the question of the month. We were asking people for their favourite podcasts and blogs and different hobby channels. And the Rule of Carnage was one that came up time and time again. It's potentially one that you listen to. And on this episode, it's the hosts of that particular podcast and YouTube channel, Mike Hutchinson and Glenn Ford, that are joining me for a conversation. So they're both very accomplished game designers in their own right, but they've kind of worked this niche for themselves where not only are they creating good games, but they spend a lot of time diving into what it means to create games. You know, the moving parts, the mechanics, the rule sets, they really not just philosophise on this stuff, but offer really actionable, practical advice as well based on their own experiences and the conversations that they're having with their own community. And that led to a very exciting opportunity for both of them because they were approached by a publisher and invited to write an academic textbook on miniature game design, which we're going to talk about on this episode as well. So I kicked things off by asking Glenn about that evolution from creating games to talking about creating games and essentially sort of teaching the process as well.
Basically, the podcast Rule of Carnage was just like, you know, me and Mike spend a lot of time talking about games and game design, you know, just anyway, driving to conventions and chatting generally. And it was just a very basic thing of like, okay, let's record these and put them out there. Because, I mean, my feeling is that wherever you think you are, like in relation to sort of designing and putting out a game, if you've gone one step, you're ahead of somebody. And so that's valuable to someone, you know. And so we wanted to record that, put that out. Hopefully, you know, people would find it valuable and like respond to it. And so, yeah, we started recording our conversations, putting them online. And then whatever it was now, sort of 2 years ago, I think, the publisher, CRC Routledge, reached out to us because basically they're wanting to extend their line of books sort of talking about designing games, frankly. And I think the commissioning editor did a Google search for designing miniature games, and because not because we're like amazingly insightful or brilliant, but because we're a small fish in a tiny pond, we popped up like 10 times on the first page of Google searches. So they reached out to us and said, would you like to do this? And we said yes immediately, because I think we're both quite, you know, I don't want to put words in Mike's mouth, but I think we're both quite passionate about extending what miniature games can do, sort of trying to build up some sort of serious critical language and ways of talking about them. Because despite it being an old and sort of significant hobby, there just isn't that much sort of properly defined technical ways of talking about the bits and pieces of it. So that's been the sort of ongoing project from there.
I think also that we've always, like, the difference between designing games and teaching or talking about how to design games, like, it's always just been really natural. Like, you and I have both always, you know, you've got to fill your website with something. And so we'd been filling it with just sort of self-reflexive musings about, like, I'm working on this game. How I want, like, let me tell you a little bit about how it's going or how I'm thinking about the campaign system or whatever. So I'd been doing that all the way through the development of Gaslands, mostly just to get stuff out of my head somewhere and sort of give myself an opportunity to analyze my own process and be kind of thoughtful about it. So that ended up being kind of like, for me at least, the root of talking about these things in a more organized manner. And to be honest with you, recording the podcasts is less work than editing a blog post. So there's that going for it as well.
Yeah.
As much as, you know, doing a show like this, like, you're putting out really good information that helps people, but how useful is it for both of you in terms of just your own design processes, Mike?
Yeah, like, amazingly. I mean, mostly because part of the design process is having a good friend to bounce ideas off. And so that sort of just provides like a weekly space for us to do that. But also forcing our own, well, I find forcing my thoughts through the lens of explaining it to a notional audience member to be just incredibly useful in terms of trying to figure out what's going on in my own games. And actually, I was doing a bit of work recently with somebody had come to me to ask some questions about their game. And I was thinking through the problems with their, like the narrative framing of their game and the fact there wasn't like a clear sort of hook for like what was going on in the world. And it just made me think, it's because I was sitting down to work on some A Billion Sun second edition stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, some of these criticisms I've leveled over there, I could well do to listen to over here. So like very immediate, like, you know, one can get on a high horse and talk hypothetically about either games in the abstract or other people's games, but turning that spotlight internally is super useful.
Yeah, and I think also, like, you know, you start talking about a particular subject and you cover like the basics, the things that you've done 100 times, most people have seen 100 times, and then you want to fill like, you know, half an hour, an hour of conversation. You start sort of pushing the envelope and questioning, oh, should we do this? Should we do that? Can you do this? Can you do that? And I think a good example for this at the moment is like Mike's game Space Skits that he's working on. I think very much came out of a conversation, you know, about the different things you can do with dice in a miniatures game, because they have a sort of a physical existence, and you've got a physical tabletop, and it's just questioning, okay, well, when I throw the dice onto the table, they're suddenly somewhere, you know, how does that relate to the miniatures? How does that relate to the game? And I think that's very much sort of that spun off into sort of where Mike went with Space Skits. So often directly sort of trying to really pull apart a particular subject leads you into interesting places where you suddenly go, yeah, no, why hasn't anybody done this before? Let's push that envelope and have a go with it and see what falls out.
So Glenn, did you have any like aha moments either doing the podcast or like writing the book that have kind of found their way into your own games and rule sets?
I think sort of certainly writing the book, part of the way we sort of divided up the work on it was that I ended up reading a lot of indie rule sets, like a lot of indie rule sets, and that sort of just clicking which things you don't need to actually sort of reiterate too heavily, which things are out there in the zeitgeist and which places you really want to focus on in writing. As I was working on the book, I was putting together Puke Apocalypse, which has just come out from Exalted Funeral. And one of the central ideas in that is that the tokens that sort of notate status have a physical presence again in the game, get laid out onto the tabletop and become sort of shapes and templates that are how you attack each other. And that sort of came from working on a section in the book talking about tokens, what are their purpose, how many of them are sort of a good idea when the table state becomes too cluttered. And I realized, like, I really hate a cluttered table, something that has tokens and bits and pieces on it that the miniatures can't see, that doesn't exist in their world. And so sort of going into that and playing around with like, okay, well, what is the miniatures I view? What is real for them? And what things can I put onto the tabletop that won't sort of break the immersion, maybe, of like what's going on, and yet still let me use templates and tokens and notation systems, and sort of bringing those things that are normally invisible to the models, like into their eye view, was very much the sort of the driver and the inspiration for the central mechanics of that game. So, yeah, I think constantly, whenever you sort of really examine your own thought processes, and try and sort of break them out into a systematic fashion, you suddenly go, well, I've always assumed that. That's something that I've just sort of taken as read. And I think, yeah, questioning that has been hugely valuable.
I should clarify for the listener as well. The book is called The Fundamentals of Tabletop Miniature Design, A Designer's Handbook. Mike, I also like your book, On Your Bike in Lancashire, a 2001 classic on Amazon. You'll have to look that one up. What's the reception to the book been like so far? And by that, I mean the designer's handbook and not the On Your Bike in Lancashire book, which I assume the reception was very good.
I mean, we've got a small slither of visibility, which is those people that have picked it up and are basically in like Discord servers that we frequent. So Rule of Carnage has its own Discord server. If you are a budding miniature games designer and want to hang out with other miniature games designers, that's a cool place to do it. And so the feedback that we've had from people who were already predisposed to like the book has been positive. So that's great. I've been fishing around for some other like external opinions to get sort of people who are, you know, in the games design community, but in different areas, or like are people who read a lot of these kinds of books. But it's been a struggle. And when you publish a new book like this, it tends to take a little while before anybody knows what the publishing numbers are, because even the like commissioning editor doesn't get the handle churned on the sales numbers for quite a while. So yeah, we don't know what the reception's been like really, but the people that we've showed it to, the people who like it was written for, which is budding miniature games designers, the kind that hang out in our Discord, are finding it useful, and it's triggering, I think, quite valuable and useful like debate about whether the things that Mike and Glenn said were right or completely right or arguable. And you know, Glenn and I have already argued with us our own words in that book since writing them down, so like we're all for arguing with Mike and Glenn. In fact, we'll be the first people in line.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I think the thing that would be most exciting to me is if a book comes out like in response to the things we've said and sort of takes a different viewpoint on them. And I think like at the moment, the part of the reason for us writing the book is that fairly regularly I get people coming up and saying, you know, where should I start reading around this subject? What's a good way to learn sort of games design, you know, that's written down and I can sort of go through? And the simple answer for a long time was there isn't any. There's the Rick Priestley book, which is great, but I often say that's like if you've got a game sort of mostly written and you want to sort of bring it through to be able to present it to other people, it's absolutely fantastic for that. But it doesn't go super detailed on like how you're physically putting a game together. And so just being able to say, okay, look, there now is a book that does that. There is an option for that, I think, you know, has been great for when people are, you know, looking for that. Like I say, at the moment, you know, small fish in a largely non-existent puddle of a pond. So, but hopefully my greatest hope is that we can open up a bit more sort of critical discourse and get some responses and people writing counterpoints. I'd love that. I think that'd be brilliant.
Yeah. It's weird because like, yeah, I mean, you can argue it a few different ways, but like, I'm gonna say that like miniatures wargaming is about 100 years older than role-playing games, but role-playing games enjoyed a little bubble of sort of this kind of linguistic sort of examination and has a bit more critical thinking already, and you can get different kinds of books and different kinds of opinions on what all this stuff means in role-playing games. So that's kind of fun because I was showing it to a role-playing game designer and proudly saying, look, we've created a bit of shared language around miniatures games, and he was like, yeah, we've got that in role-playing, we could do with a bit less of that in role-playing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think that's partly it. It's like for whatever reason, this just hasn't happened.
Is there a feeling of pressure to a certain extent when you become the people that have literally wrote the book on the subject, and somebody might look at your own games and say, oh, look at this, you know, tell me what to do, and I've played this and it's not very good.
Bro. It's fine.
Yeah, no, I for me personally, no, simply because, again, it's sort of undiscovered country. It is like I genuinely don't feel like we're sort of setting ourselves up as authorities. We're setting ourselves up as a like more of a voice in the wilderness and just going, okay, look, nobody's saying anything. Is it this? is this word appropriate? Is this term appropriate? Is this like, is this what a miniatures game is? Is this not what a miniatures game is? And hopefully we're sort of moderately approachable. You know, we're sort of two random guys on the internet. So I don't think we're like sitting. I hope we're not setting ourselves up as sort of academic authorities on these things. And you know, yeah, absolutely. If people want to apply what we've said to our games, you know, I think as Mike said, as soon as you put a game into a solid form and put it out there, and it becomes a permanent single thing, you're usually one of the first people to start looking at it and going, oh, I wish I'd done this instead or that instead. Oh no, that was an awful, you know, idea. I mean, it works, but I've got something much, much, much better now.
People like, from a player's perspective, new editions of a game you can have feelings about new editions of a game, but from a designer's perspective, new editions of game are like a wonderful opportunity to fix all of the stuff that you hate about your own design, because you're the person who's like closest to it and can see all of its warts.
Mike, how, you know, in your own experience, how inevitable is it that a person will go from becoming a gamer to start homebrewing stuff to eventually maybe create their own rule set? Like, how often do you see this happen, and what's the kind of timeline?
Well, I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about writing the textbook was the like excuse to go back to all of the like 60s books and read Featherstone and read Charles Grant and read all this stuff that like inspired the first generation of Games Workshop designers, because they were living in that world. And so I guess like what became apparent to me is that like in the before times, everyone was a games designer. There were literally no games. So if you had models and were playing games, you had to have designed something. And then I think, like, the more I think about my upbringing and the more I retell and elaborate and perhaps mythologize my own like journey into games design, like I think a lot about, you know, the Citadel Journal and like the sort of the rules that they put in White Dwarf that just sort of gave us permission to hack the systems. And and then, you know, Glenn and I always talk about how you should write your own scenarios as a good way of getting in. And that was like one of the things that I was doing a lot, you know. In fact, both of us were doing a lot for like, you know, a period of many years. So I think that like on some level, I struggle to imagine anyone not like ultimately being some kind of at least home brewer of something at their table. And I think that's partly just inherent in the form that like, the games that are written for miniatures tend to be written as sort of engines, because they have to support the like import of all this weird stuff. Like if you've got a bunker, it might be completely different shape and size to my bunker. Yours might have doors, mine might have a roof that comes off. And so it has to have all this flexibility. And so you're kind of just, even by putting terrain on the table, you're like engaging in a sort of hacking of the system and a sort of like you're participating in the design of the game. Kind of in a way that like all games masters are also at some level, like at the very least they're like game experience designers, but in many respects they're also just games designers, and they make edits to the rules as they go along. So I think that everyone is a games designer who's playing miniature games pretty much at like some level of the scale. And then the question that you asked about like how long does it take them to get there, I don't know. I think that's just a proclivity. That's just like some people might find themselves in a situation where like the opportunity to write a scenario for a weekend's game day, or, you know, they start running tournaments and then they want to make tweaks to the rules because of the competitive scene. Like there's a bunch of different routes in, or like a lot of us in the community that we've created, like there's just some kind of game experience that we kind of want to have, or we've got miniatures, but we don't have quite the way that we want to play with it. And so taking a little risk, hacking a system or coming up with something. Yeah.
Yeah, I think from what Mike's saying there, like the older Featherstone books, I think reading those, it's very significant that back then it was everybody had their own rule set. You went to someone's house to play a game and they had their version of their rules that they had sort of put together. And then I think the hobby went through like, a codification around like GW's sort of rise, where it was like, okay, well, this is what a minis game is. I think at the moment we're going through a sort of secondary explosion of like indie games, little games, It's so easy now with like War Games Vault and something like things like that for people to put together their own rule set, stick it up online, and people can very quickly become publishers. I think like in relation to sort of the passage of going from a gamer to a games designer, one of the things I found, like, you know, as a teenager, it was sort of writing units and characters and et cetera, that you wanted to use in your army. And even if they weren't horribly overpowered, they had lots of like little gotchas and tricks, and other people were like, I'm just not playing against that. You're not allowed to use it. It's too powerful. And for me, like the step, and I think probably for a lot of people, is going from writing things for yourself to use because you think they're cool, and then writing something that your friend is willing to use with you, or even writing a thing for your friend to use against you. Like, and I think that's why scenarios and campaigns are great ways in, because whenever you're writing a scenario, you're hopefully writing it for, you know, more than one person. You're like, I want to show this scenario to my friend, and I want him to go, yes, we're playing that. That's what we're doing this session. I'm excited about it. And learning to write with the sort of the perspective of the other player, I think is like a huge, huge step to go from, like, you know, sort of a bit of rules bashing and a bit of knocking things together for yourself to something that you're putting out to the public, something you're giving to other people, and sort of coming across into being, I don't use the term a proper games designer because everybody's a games designer, but like the step towards doing something public and open and that other people want to be a part of, at least.
Cryo Volcano, a solo scenario that could be played with any sci-fi skirmish rule set and miniatures, is now available on the Bedroom Battlefields Patreon. It was originally published in Miniature Wargames magazine, and you'll now find everything you need to play it, along with a whole host of additional bonus content, over at patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. That's patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. And now, back to the show. This is potentially a big can of worms and a whole conversation of its own. But Mike, what are some of the most common mistakes that you see new games designers making?
The most common mistake is not designing a game because they are worried about whether they've got what it takes. So I was chatting to someone on Zoom a couple of weeks back, and they were really excited about the idea of making something, but really, I don't know, just nervous about whether they had what it takes. And I was trying to find 10 to 15 different ways of saying, you probably don't have what it takes the first time. Like, imagine painting like the Sistine Chapel. Are you going to nail that first time? No, the first, like, why would you expect to be able to paint a painting amazingly the first time, or like write a song amazingly the first time, or, you know, write a novel the first time you sit down to write a novel? Like, why would that be any different for games design? Like, the first time you design a game, it's going to be awful. It's going to be horrible. It's going to fall to pieces. You're probably not going to finish it. It's going to be a disaster. It's going to be childish and amateurish. Great. Like, great. Do that. Now do 10 more of those. And by the time you get to the 10th one, like, you'll probably have something that like feels like it's coming. And I guess that's also one of the things that people get an idea for a game, and then that becomes a little bit of a like a talisman that they don't want to waste their good idea on a bad game, and they don't want to write a bad game with their good idea. So they kind of get caught in this loop where they don't start. And I guess that was, I was giving this advice to someone in the Discord a couple of months ago, which was like, okay, you've got a good idea, write 3 games with that good idea, because that will separate like your implementation of that idea from your love for that idea. Just like allow yourself to write that game multiple times, because that mistake where I have written this idea once, therefore I'm never allowed to use it again, that's also nonsense. That's like not allowing yourself to draft something multiple times, which, of course, you know, if you were writing something, you'd allow yourself to change a sentence as many times as you wanted. Or if you're recording a song, you'd do multiple takes. Or if you were shooting a movie, you'd make multiple takes and choose the best. Like, I think, yeah, I think that for me, like, those characterize like how to get over that creative sort of barrier of escaping from your own perfectionism, even if your perfectionism is more like I'm scared that I even will be able to make something stand up. Because the answer is you probably won't. Just crack on creating a broken stool and then figure out how to make a whole table in a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sort of giving yourself permission to make absolute garbage is a big step in sort of becoming a designer. I think somebody in the Discord the other day said something along the lines of, I want to design a game, but I'm not a games designer, so I don't think I can. And it's like, nobody was a games designer before they designed their first game. You're not born with it. You sit down and you start, and it goes well or it goes badly. And I think, like, sometimes people have like one idea for a game. And the one thing I've learned is that the thing that will cause you to come up with more ideas for more games is writing the first one. Because as you're putting it together, you're suddenly going to go, oh, well, what about this other idea and this other path? And that becomes a different game. I think if there was a consistent issue I see with first designs, to maybe get a bit more practical, it is things being over-designed, too many rules, too many bits and pieces. And I think that comes from people going like, I might only get one shot at this, so every idea that I get whilst writing is going in there. Every little thing, every sort of little jink and jank. And I've done it, and I know Mike's done it. Like, sometimes there are rules that are nice and are a good idea, but don't really fit in the game and distract from... They sort of, you bury the lead sometimes, where it's like, you know, the good thing you're doing is X, and then you put in all the rest of the alphabet, and the players just end up being buried under not knowing which button is the fun button, and having to learn all this sort of baroque rules around it. And if there's a single piece of advice I could give to a new games designer, it's like, try and cut like five rules from whatever game you're writing, because you've probably got too many in there. That's the average error. I don't see many underwritten first games. I'll say that much.
One of the, just going back to the sort of good ideas factor there that you were speaking about, like one of the most like relevant things I'd heard you say on the podcast was talking about how, you know, you maybe hear from people that tell you they've got a good idea for a game, or they're not sharing their idea because they think people would steal it. And I remember one of you saying, like, nobody wants your idea. Like, everyone's got loads of ideas. Like, the idea is the very, very easy part. And
I've got plenty of my own ideas. You think I want to waste my time on yours? I got bags back here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's and like, not just from the Discord and not just from Rule of Carnage, but like I frequent Board Game Geek design threads, and the thing you see most often is people being like, well, how do I protect myself from people stealing my idea? My idea is like amazing. How do I cover it? Do I do NDAs? Do I do, you know, trademark? And it is just genuinely, and it's not dismissive, and it's not because your idea is not good. Nobody wants to steal your idea. The number of like you know, times that you see sort of ideas being copied in tabletop is extremely rare, considering like you know, how many people there are out designing and how many games there are.
And also, when you see it happening in the video game world, like, it's mostly just unavoidable anyway. Like, the mobile app store is just absolutely filled with people ripping each other off. So even if you wanted to protect yourself, and that provides a fertile set of examples for why, like, it's kind of a losing battle anyway.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it's like, your game is never going to be anything until you show it to somebody. It's certainly, in my opinion, it's never going to be good until you've shown it to, like, another person and gotten their feedback and gotten their response. But it's not going to be a game until you put it out there and somebody else can see it and somebody else can engage with it. And I really think the earlier you can do it, the better. It's like I say, like Mike said, like I've said a few times, I've got more sort of game ideas than I could, you know, finish if I just sat there and wrote games and nothing else for literally the rest of my life. And I know that as I'm writing them, another like you know, 20 ideas can spin off from every one of those. It's like, I don't have the time to steal your idea, you know. And the thing about my ideas is I think they're great because they're my ideas. They're from my head. You know, I'm passionate and excited about them. The odds of your idea being more exciting to me than my idea, it's a bizarre concept. So it's like, no, if you're worried, just let that go. Get the idea out there, show it to someone, get other people's eyes on it. You know, as soon as another human being steps in and looks at your game, it's going to just like jump 100% in its quality, in its depth, in its worth, in its sort of progress towards being something worthwhile and completed, I think.
I found myself, like, I've got a couple of, like, fledgling rule sets that I tinker away with, and I found myself, like, spending time on the wrong things. Like, I write for a living, so the writing of the rules, the presenting of the rules, in theory, should be an easy part for me, but I find it really difficult. And then I think to myself, like, I'm wasting my time, like, you know, grammatical minutiae here and there, and I'm like, I could just play it again. That would be much more useful. And then as much as you guys, and, you know, I think you both listen to the Board Game Design podcast as well, which is a really good show. And, you know, the amount of times that playtesting gets emphasized, and it's this incredible moment where you take something to the table and you're like, the thing that seemed obviously flawless just breaks in front of you. And you're like, oh, so that's why I'm testing it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like when you're writing the rules, you're sort of theorizing where things are going to be, like sometimes literally physically, and you're sort of trying to hold it all in your own head. And the first time you physically lay it all out on the tabletop, there's almost always a moment when you go, oh no, this thing's now meant to be in two places at once, or this thing is totally invisible to the other player, or this thing hasn't been laid out. And yeah, getting it to the tabletop, it's usually the most painful part in so many ways of game design playtesting. It requires you to physically get stuff together and do it. Everything falls apart the first few times. You know you're going to have so much work to do sort of reiterating afterwards, but it's so valuable. It's so important. Like, you know, it's shocking the number of times I see people who have a game that has never physically gone to the table and they think it's going to work and going to hold together. And it just doesn't, because you need to physically get it out there and get it playing and get minis on the table to check it over.
How often do you guys find yourselves playtesting? Like if you're working on something, I mean, does this depend on how far along the rules are, or, you know, what's starting with you, Mike? Like, what's your sort of frequency there?
I mean, it really depends on what opportunities I've got available. Like, I can invent a hypothetical amount that I would like to playtest, but like, because a lot of this just relies on, you know, the generosity of friends, like it's a matrix of like their availability and the number of projects that I'm working on. So I think I kind of picked up from Glenn this sort of studiousness around solo playtesting and like being very thorough about how much work you do, like with the game in front of you on the table, working through all the different scenarios and permutations and stuff. Because I think particularly for Gaslands, like I did a bit of like messing about, sort of experimenting with ideas and stuff, but I would always say, okay, then I'm going to take it to the club and we'll playtest it there. And that was good because it allowed me to do a lot of playtesting, but it's also a much longer loop to go round, and it's expensive in terms of your like friends' dedication to that. And so I think playing game, one of the things that I found useful about running a YouTube channel as part of, you know, Planet Smasher Games is that I can now video myself playing the games and talk to camera. And then I've got like a notional audience member that I'm communicating with. And I have to just do it a little bit more structured, a little bit more kind of organized. And I've got to like get through the game and stuff. So for me, getting to a place where I can get solo playtesting humming has been really important. And for me, like recording that so that I've got this like this phantom audience member has been a kind of an important part of that, because I wasn't able to just sort of, I would end up just like pushing some cars around and then sort of scratching my head and then going and making a cup of tea and sort of drifting away. Glenn is a lot more structured in his approach to many things in life, and solo playtesting is one of the ones I've picked up on.
Yeah, I think personally there's sort of three stages of playtesting, or at least hopefully there's the solo testing, where for me, I'll solo playtest something over and over and over and over, and particularly I'll want to solo playtest it before I waste another person's time on it, because other people's time, and particularly other people who are willing to sit there and playtest your game, is very valuable. And so solo testing is really valuable to work out the really obvious kinks, the things that you're just like, why did I ever think that was going to be a thing and going to work? And also it's great for letting you like test different scenarios and test different units and test things against each other, because you can just do like the bit of testing you need and just stop halfway through and not care that someone was actually maybe getting into it, and just going, right, okay, I'm pulling those units off and I'm just replacing this unit with another one in the middle of the thing, and you don't have to explain to other people, you know, and try and keep like diligent notes, and yeah, if you can record yourself. Then there's the playtesting with yourself and another human being, which for me is very much often a sort of like playing it and then going, is this fun? Is this in any way enjoyable? Is this a thing? Because like you can solo test it in a way that you can like work out the mechanics and you can get it to like not physically break during play. But it's really, really hard to judge whether the experience is enjoyable just because you're so like focused in on the minutiae of the mechanics and the things that are clicking along, and every rule is obvious to you and is like engraved in your brain because that's where it came from. So the idea of there being like too many Baroque rules and too many things to hold in your head at any one time whilst playing, it just doesn't make any sense to the designer. And sometimes having another human being go just sort of put their head down as you give them the fifth thing to remember is, it's like, okay, brilliant. Okay, that's too many. We need to stop there. And then like the third stage.
Can I just interrupt before the third stage? So I particularly enjoy playtesting with my 7-year-old daughter because her emotions are very close to the surface. So if I put together a situation that's maybe too complicated or unfair, she will sometimes just burst into tears. And I'm just like, oh, this is just feedback. The most pure, rare, like rarefied playtesting feedback. Because, you know, someone else who's a grown man will sort of be a bit disgruntled about, this doesn't seem very fair. No, just like my daughter will just break down into tears about how unfair this bit of the game is. I'm like, yep, we better fix this.
Yeah. And then like the last part, and the one that's often the hardest to get like a lot of feedback on, it is blind testing. You know, being able to give your game with no like notes and explanation to a total stranger and find out whether you wrote down the things that you thought you had written down. Because like if you're testing and you're across the tabletop from somebody else, no matter how hard you try, you're going to explain a certain amount just by your reactions to what they're doing a lot of the time. And it's shocking how many times you suddenly realize, oh, I just didn't write that rule down. I never put it down. It's in my head and it's always been there because I've been around the table. And so like, I think blind testing, at the very least, like just having somebody else go over your rule set, even if they don't physically get it to the table, is super valuable. And then if you're lucky enough to get like a total stranger print out your rules, play a game with it, and then come back to you, that's like, if you can just do that a few times, I think you're doing pretty well. But you can never, ever, ever, ever playtest things enough. It's been said a few times that like, the most playtested game in history, once it gets released, it then gets more playtests in the first like 24 hours than it's had the whole of its development. And that's like, it is frustrating sometimes when you put a game out and people are like, well, how did they not spot this? And it's like, well, because before we really playtested the hell out of it and it got like 100 playtests. Now it's released, it immediately got like 500 in the first 24 hours and it's been out for a couple of months. So it's like, yeah, you're going to find somebody is going to find something. You can only cover so much.
that must cause a lot of paralysis for people, for finally publishing a game, whether that is through their own, you know, self-publishing means or trying to maybe pitch it to, I mean, if you're, say, pitching, I think Osprey do the open calls, so if you're going down that route, I guess, like how much help would you then get from the publisher to iron out any kinks if they were interested in your game?
I guess it depends on the publisher, but the general answer is not much. And the reality of that is because like we're operating in a niche market where there's not a ton of money, and so like that sort of resource is just that's too rich for most game projects. And so as the designer, you're kind of expected to bring all of that for yourself. And that's why I'm so cautious about my friends' energy and enthusiasm about playtesting another of my terrible games, is because like they're kind of my most valuable resource. They're like people who understand me and my sort of my goals for the games I'm making, but they're also like, you know, used to playtesting, and they're friends of mine, so they don't mind like giving me it real. And that's why I think building community around your games even before they're released is so important. Like having a community of people who are willing to test, to play the game and give you feedback, then they are willing to talk about the game when it comes out, and kind of be the beginning of a community that can form around the game. I think that's all like totally critical.
Yeah, I do think it varies significantly from one publisher to the next. Like, Exalted Funeral were brilliant. They actually gave me a game developer who actually went through and worked through the wording, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, you know, I worked with other publishers, and I think Michael sort of backed this up. There are other publishers who won't even proofread what you give them, much less give you actual feedback on the mechanics and the layout and the presentation of the game. So that varies hugely, and I think sort of it's worth assuming that you won't really get sort of much in the way of development from a publisher. And like Mike says, that's why it's like super valuable to have some people around that you trust, ideally sort of relatively close to you, to hopefully fulfill that role if you need it filling in.
Mm.
Well, you guys rolled in the hobby, like, I would assume first and foremost you still see yourself as games designers before, like, teaching game design, but because you've worked yourself into this niche with the podcast and with the book, is, like, consultancy anything you've explored, anything you've done so far, like people actually working one-to-one or one-to-two with you to work on their own games and get feedback from you?
Personally speaking, yes. Like, that's actually started to go into more of like a professional consultancy. So I had my first gig at the start of this year, working with a small miniature games company. They've got a Kickstarter coming up. They want a little bit of help sharpening up the game's design and thinking through some of the core concepts around their background. And so I was able to do a couple of days' work with the games design and the creative lead on that. And I think Glenn and I have both had lots of experiences of people coming to us and sort of saying like, hey, can I just get a little bit of advice, or can I get a bit of time here just to sort of chat something through? And that's kind of, I guess I see that more like mentorship rather than consultancy. One of them has invoices at the end of it.
Yeah. I've had like a couple of paid gigs editing and going over rule sets for people, but I think most of it is it's part of a community thing where, you know, if somebody puts up a rule set and asks for feedback, I'll try and do sort of a run over it and pick out the most obvious things. But yeah, you know, I have done sort of paid consulting on rules, and I'm happy to do that in the future. But I think the vast majority of it is, you know, like everything in the indie area, when somebody starts working on a game, they don't know what they're going to do with it. They don't know if they're ever going to actually put it out and actually try and make money off of it. So you have to already be in a quite advanced state of where you're going with the game before you know I it is worth me paying somebody to sort of go over the rules and come back to me. I think if you don't have somebody to do that, you know, that you trust it, that is a worthwhile thing to do. But it's a lot like thing. It's like commissioning art. It's like you're going to need to commission art probably before you put a game out, like, professionally. But 99% of the games that I see are never going to do that because they never believe that they're going to make any money. And the vast majority of them don't. They're just done because people love the idea and love the game and want to put it out there. So I totally understand they're not going to sort of want to invest in consulting over the rules.
Glenn, how do you see the next few years for our corner of the hobby, you know, this very indie space? I know we've got Games Workshop, which is a whole world of their own, but do you see more folks coming in, more folks trying to make games, just a continuous period of growth, or what's your thoughts there?
I mean, my feeling is that it's an area of game design that has a huge opportunity to do a lot of much more interesting things. Like, as Mike was saying before, like, you look at the RPG space, and as we've said, sort of RPGs have gone from sort of just basic goblin bashing dungeon crawlers to a place now where you can have everything from, you know, two people falling in love over a Jenga tower to, you know, shared multi-GM heist movies, whilst, like, in the minis tabletop space, we've gone from goblins bashing each other's heads in to goblins bashing each other's heads in to some other goblins bashing each other's heads in one or another iteration, and I'm starting to see, like, more of a movement in things like non-combat minis game design, you know, areas within the sort of Inc. 28 movement that are starting to put out more like, okay, what other stories can we tell? Can we tell a romance with minis? Can we tell, you know, a murder mystery? Can we do this? Can we do that? What is unique to a tabletop miniatures game that can tell these stories in different ways? So I'm very hopeful that we're going to see, like, a growth of the different subjects that can be approached. And I think that as those different subjects get approached, we're going to see different sorts of people coming into the hobby and hopefully different sorts of people designing games. So, you know, I think that with the growth in, like, the ability to put a game out there, like, digitally and independently, you can now put a PDF rule set out within, like, 24 hours, and it's open to the entire world. You can get together a set of SDLs and they can be available so that, like, somebody on the other side of the planet can be downloading your game, putting together a set of miniatures, getting to the tabletop without you having to physically manufacture anything. And your game can be played and be out there. And I think that's, like, a really exciting thing. And I hope that we see, like, more of a breadth of ideas and concepts and things approached. It's like, I love a you know, smash 'em up battle game, but you are well served if that is what you are looking for. And I'd like to see, like, things for people who are looking for something else supported a bit more. I'm excited about it, and I'm hopeful about it. I think there's more coming up.
Any thoughts, Mike?
I think one of the things that I wish to exist, I'm not going to make this, but I hope someone does, is I think there's something missing about the connection between gamers, makers of 3D models, and designers of indie rule sets. And I feel like the existing places that I can download rule sets and the existing places that I can download STLs are, like, quite distant and unconnected. And I also can't easily sort of form communities around those games. And, like, because ultimately, like, I see a couple things. One is I see miniatures being, like, the more miniatures I acquire, the more possible games I can play with them. And I like acquiring miniatures from Games Workshop. They are, like, you know, they're convenient, they're high quality, you know, they're lovely objects. I'd like a way for like me or other people to discover more uses for those miniatures. And equally, like, it would be great to be like, okay, I've discovered this, you know, miniature agnostic game that I'm excited about. Like, how can I find the miniatures without having to sort of scroll around the entire internet and all these strange half broken sites? So I think that, like, one thing is it's really fun to see people like One Page Rules kind of really making a connection between 3D printing and rules, like in a structured way. I just think there's also an opportunity for like a community platform to bring gamers, game designers, and 3D model makers together in a way that could be really exciting. So if you have the skills, go make that happen, please. That would be lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, totally. It's like, you know, I've got Steam and Mike is my friend on Steam. So every now and again, Steam pops up and says, Mike has this game. He has played it. He likes it. And it'd be lovely if, like, you could go on Wargame Vault and follow Mike and see what he has downloaded from Wargame Vault. And then it had a little thing of, and here's a link across to the My Mini Factory page of the minis that Mike used to play this game that he is enjoying, you know. But that sort of connectivity and that community, I think, it's going to take somebody with more knowledge of how to do these things than I to put out there, but that would be lovely to see.
I'm conscious of not taking up too much more of your time. I just wanted to kind of get into what you're working on at the moment and what's in the pipeline. So, Glenn, you talked about Puke Apocalypse. Is that still to come out then?
That came out start of January, I think, from Exalted Funeral. So that's out there and available, and people can pick it up from them. Or if you're in the UK and you don't want to pay the shipping charges, I've got it on my website, so you can order it off of there. Hopefully, I've got a few things coming out. I'm looking to take Boards and Black Flags, a pirate-based game with dynamic environments, to Kickstarter around April, May time. And hopefully I've got a co-op sort of Squid Game, Alice in Borderlands style game coming out at some point this year from another publisher. So yeah, got a few things going on, and then there's always stuff going up on Itch and the Patreon and things like that. Try and put out about a game, a little teeny game there at least about once a month.
Mike, Pacific Command, I think I've seen that on Amazon May. They had that penciled in for. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Yeah, no, that is accurate. So Pacific Command is my World War II game of carrier warfare and fog of war. And it's a sort of zoomed out strategic game. So it's coming out from Offspray. It'll be in their Blue Book range. I'm kind of excited to see what people make of that. It's kind of a Mike Hutchinson game through and through. it started with the fairly sane idea of like, oh, the combat system in A Billion Suns seems like it would work for World War II carrier battles. Let's try and make that work. And then it span its own mad path, and now it uses poker chips and all kinds of hidden bluffing information. So I'm excited to see Pacific Command come out from Osprey in May. At the time of this recording coming out, I'm currently running a Kickstarter for a role-playing game called The Crawling Chaos. This is my first Kickstarter. This is a part of Zine Quest. So I've got a 32-page role-playing game. This is a zine-sized role-playing game of weird demises. It's a Lovecraftian story game with one player character and many GMs. So go back that. Go search for that and back it, please. And then that is partly because I want to get that game out there because I think it's cool, partly because I want to make some mistakes ahead of what I hope will be a larger Kickstarter project in March and April, which is for Space Kits, my dexterity game of drunk-ass space orcs. So check that out. The preview page is up on Kickstarter, and you can click the little button that will let you know when it goes live. That's enough. Those three things, that's enough for now. There's more stuff in the pipeline, which I will talk about later, but those are my main focuses at the moment.
It's confession time in our February question of the month, as we ask you to list your last three hobby purchases. Whether you've picked up a cheap set of brushes on Amazon, an obscure new rule set on Wargames Vault, or an appallingly brilliant Manticore miniature on eBay, be sure to tell us all about it. Far from being judged, I'm pretty sure you'll find yourself in very good company. Get your audio clip in over at bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, and I need them in by Thursday the 27th of February. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now, back to the show. A massive thanks to Glenn and Mike for joining me for a very enjoyable conversation. And yeah, they're both very busy guys, so I really appreciate their time and willingness to speak to this humble podcast. So I've got a lot of links to the book, to their games and stuff like that. You'll find them in the show notes in your podcast app, or you could fire on over to bedroombattlefields.com to find them as well. And one of Mike's games is, of course, Hobgoblin, the mass fantasy battle game. And it was a game that I had the opportunity to play for the very first time just a couple of days ago with Callum, aka Dr. Spork. We had a very good game of Hobgoblin. So we're going to switch now to a little recording that I did with Callum immediately after that game, just to get some of our thoughts in the moment. All right then, Callum, we finally had this game of Hobgoblin. It feels like we've been talking about it for ages, but yeah, the battle is over. So I mean, talk us through your initial thoughts before we get into maybe a more in-depth analysis of the battle.
Well, yeah, it was good fun. It was fairly quick, ended very quickly, you know. Everything just kind of falls apart at the end quite suddenly, and it's all on the cliff edge. Felt quite nicely balanced, actually, though. I enjoyed that. Yeah. And I won, so.
Yeah, I mean, definitely looking at the table, like, it looks very comprehensive. But like you're saying, there was a couple of wee things that happened towards the end that kept it on that knife edge, wasn't there? I mean, particularly your standard encouraging or raising the courage of those around them. So when I finally got my dwarfs into battle, which took about 70 turns, I think. There was a wee chance that there could have been a cascade of panic there, but it didn't quite work out for me, did it?
No, you know, one dice, I think. Mm-hmm. One dice roll out of hundreds would have done it, and my army would have just pegged it off the board. So, it was interesting. Yeah, I like that. I like that, though, that there was a lot of tension in that last turn. And we got there reasonably quickly for playing a new game for the first time.
Yeah, so we decided to, I mean, it was easy to not use the magic phase or magic rules because there were no actual wizards in the two armies anyway, but that'll be something to bring in for next time. And we decided in the end not to use the fortune deck as well, didn't we? So we were just trying to get a feel for the game before adding these little like bells and whistles in, I suppose.
Yeah, I just kept forgetting that the cards were there. So it was one less thing to remember. I think it was when I played with Space Weirdos with Ed in Bring Out Your Lead, because there were a lot of new players there. He got rid of command points, and it's a similar sort of thing where you've got little extra things that you can do. But when you're trying to learn all the other rules, it's difficult to remember everything. And so it's one of these things you forget about. So I thought, well, we thought for the first game, maybe we'll do without him. Right. Worked nicely.
Yeah, I mean, the rules definitely, as much as I'd had a dry run of a turn myself, it's when you start playing with somebody else, I think that's when it starts properly sinking in. And it's not a complicated rule set by any means. I don't think we really struggled with much. We didn't find ourselves in the book too much, did we? There was a couple of wee points of clarification I think we needed with the distracted rule and seeking out whether when you hit your courage limit, if it was like on that number or one over. So we had to check a couple of wee things. But in the end, the book was played a minimal role, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we were able to find all the information as well in the book, which is not always the case with rule books. I think particularly with some of the older Warhammer rule books, you can be searching forever and you just got to know someone who knows all the rules inside out. No, it's easy to pick up. I think I said to you as well, I could see myself maybe making an even littler set than this to go with my travel set if I wanted to do it. And this would be the perfect rule set for that, because you scale it down from inches to centimetres, it'd work great on a 1.5 foot square almost, you know, or 2 foot square, less than that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're playing on a 4x4 here, and although it's 15 mil scale, we kept it with the inches rather than going to centimetres. I know you maybe could have done that, but I think it worked totally well with the inches. So again, the listener could see the photos at bedroombattlefields.com/hobgoblin, but we've got a river running through the the table, and that was really interesting, wasn't it? Like you very kindly printed out a bridge, which is really cool. So that was an option for getting troops over, but they could also take a doom token for getting into the river. And in the end, that is like a lot of the combat kind of ended up in that river as well, which made it really interesting.
Yeah, I realised by accident at first that I'd lined them up on the far side of the river, which meant your guys charged in and were left stood in the river, which with these rules we figured would mean they get a doom token every turn they're stood in the river, which makes sense if you're finding a river. But it gave me a tactical advantage that I hadn't actually planned. And of course I went straight for the bridge as well, because I figured that was a kind of tactical thing to do, is to just to get over the bridge. I'm not very tactically minded generally, and will kind of accidentally fall into these things. But it did make a difference, and it gave you more to think about. I think there was one point where I was worried that one of my units was going to die just because they were stood in the river. Mm. There was no one was going to hurt them. I needed to reverse a unit of trolls out of the river because they couldn't go forwards and they couldn't stay in the river. So, it was just, the your terrain was lovely.
Thank you. My little houses. I must return the compliment on your bridge as well. I like how you'd painted the little a little troll as well. He's like peeking out. I'll put a photo up on the site of that as well. But I attempted to be tactical by deploying on my right hand flank. I used all my range. I had a lot more ranged capabilities than you. So we both had two units of archers. I also had crossbows and a cannon. So I deployed them on the right flank, and then put my kind of hardest infantry in the middle, and then on the left flank I had two units of heavy cavalry. But I think I made a bit of a mistake there, because they followed each other one after the other, the cavalry down, and I think I wasted one of them. But the sort of middle of my army, I think they held on respectably considering how flanked they got. Like I had those foot knights who were really tough. You know, they were getting hit from the flank and from the front. They were having to split their attacks when they were fighting back, but they had a couple of perks that probably made them last a wee bit longer. And then when the dwarves finally got there, because they were moving on 4-inch, so when they finally got there, they did decent as well. But I think at that point they were going to struggle. But it got interesting down in that sort of middle area, didn't it?
Oh yeah, no, your dwarves, like I say, they could have swung the end of that game. They did really well. They had my general at the front and a unit of heavy cavalry in the side, unit of heavy cavalry in the back, and they took them right to the edge. Like literally one more doom on nearly any of those units actually, and everything would have just fallen apart. Like that, I had four or five units facing off against two of your units in the middle of the board. And if you'd just inflicted one more doom on any of those units with the dwarves, all of those units would have gone, because they were just right on the edge. You know, they were like right on the edge of it. And the only thing that was keeping them there was the commander and the battle standard giving them a wee boost. So it really could have gone any way right at the end, which actually surprised me, because when you looked at it, it looked very one way.
Yeah.
But then when you kind of look a bit deeper and you see all the things and see all the doom tokens, then yeah, it was literally on a dice roll. One dice roll would have done it. But I had fun, and that was great actually. That gave it a really kind of, you know, cinematic. It would have been, you know, it would have been nice if your dwarves had actually pulled it off.
Yeah.
You know, they'd finally got in a battle. They'd defeated the war boss, and everyone else had just legged it, kind of thing. It would have been a lovely cinematic moment, which could have happened, but the dice gods weren't with us. So
there were a couple of notable battles worth talking about. I mean, the first one, the two leadership groups. So grab 'em, eyeball sack. I charged them with Dick Longfellow, and you came out on top there. I had a limp dick in the river by the end of it. So grab him. He's still on the table there, and he's got bragging rights in the leadership fight, hasn't he?
I mean, only just. You gave Eyeballsack a good pummeling. I'm not. I think I said to you during the game, I'm not normally very good at actually winning games. I think it's pure luck personally. I think I did very well, and it was a good game. I really enjoyed it.
So what about, what's his name, the big giant orc?
Rotbelch the Colossal.
Yeah, so Rotbelch the Colossal, he marched over the bridge and he charged straight into the cannon, which had been annoying him, to say the least. It had taken a couple of pot shots at him, but yeah, he got into melee combat, and then how many sixes did I roll? You've got a photo of it, don't you?
I have a photo. Yeah.
So these two little guys at the cannon, one of them's holding a brush, the other one, I mean, he's holding a cannonball, but he's got a dagger in his belt, and this huge giant orc comes up.
10 dice, you rolled
seven sixes out of 10, and killed him.
You needed sixes to hit.
Yeah, it was sixes to hit. So this couple of wee guys behind the cannon just somehow killed this giant orc.
But I think it was mutually assured destruction, because he took them out at the same time. So I think we figured that he'd stuck his finger in the end of the cannon, blowing everything up.
Yeah.
They'd tried to launch one last volley at him as he charged in. But that was good. That was fun. That was a nice little, just a little bit of story to the battle.
Yeah, I'd benefited from us being a bit careless, hadn't I? Because the cannon had the fragile. I was going to call it a perk. It's not a perk. So they should have been doomed, because they had 6 doom points. So I don't really know that they should have still been involved at that stage. But anyway, I'll take it. It was a good moment.
Yeah, no, I think we agreed that we realised that when the combat started that actually they should be out of there, because it seemed a bit odd that they were actually so tough as a unit. But I don't mind. I think we let that slide because we'd made the mistake, and you know what? It led to a fun moment where you rolled 7 sixes and took out a troll got hit over the head with a brush or whatever. But you know, it was, yeah, no, these things happen, especially when you're learning a new rule set.
I must also say, by the way, thank you very much, not only for bringing a printed bridge, but a lamassu as well. You've got me a lamassu, which is great, because I think I'd been going on about how I wish I had one of them again. So I'll definitely get him painted up. He'll be at 28 mil, but I've got a little wee warbands that he'll fit right into. So thank you for that.
Oh, no, you're very welcome. No, it's the least I can do for the wonderful podcast you provide us all.
Well, apparently you're a better sounding podcaster than me, so you could launch a competition show. But we'll go and get some lunch now and discuss the game further.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, and had fun.
Big thanks to Callum for coming through to entertain me with that game. Not only entertain me, but beat me comprehensively. And we had a nice bit of macaroni and cheesecake for lunch afterwards, which was really nice. And yeah, Hobgoblin, great game. Like I found myself in the afternoon after that game, I just wanted to play it again. So I can't wait to try it out. There are solo rules in the book, which I'll definitely give that a bash. But you can't beat playing against someone else, especially somebody like Callum, who very much in the same mindset as myself when it comes to gaming and miniatures and all that stuff. So we hopefully won't leave it too long until we get a rematch there. I get the opportunity to extract some revenge, or maybe try and stay out of the river this time. And I also heard an unconfirmed rumour that Callum went straight home and got on the Ralpartha site and started building a 15 mil army of his own. So we'll see about that, whether I'll be facing up against a completely new army the next time around. Alright then, that's just about it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. I hope you enjoyed that one as much as I did. And make sure you're subscribed or following on your podcast listening app of choice, and we'll catch up with you next time around. Cheers!